Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, ClassicRock.About.com, Rolling Stone, BGO Records, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening, 10 Mile Stereo, is brought to us by a group called Beach House. We'll be hearing more from this contemporary rock group, Beach House, later on in today's program, and they'll be closing out today's program as well. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us once again from www.triviaplane.com. Question number one, what rock group's only beardless member is Frank Beard? Big hint here. This band was formed in Houston in 1969, and it's named for a combination of two popular cigarette rolling papers. What's the name of that band whose only beardless member is named Frank Beard? Question number two, what Beatles song advises, "One thing I can tell you is you got to be free"? Hint, it's the opening song track on their 1969 album, Abbey Road. What's the name of that song that advises, "One thing I can tell you is you got to be free"? The answers to these two very important trivia questions are given at the end of, as usual, today's program. This next article is brought to us by NewsObserver.com, published on September 28, 2010, entitled, Gloria Estefan Climbs Windows During the Dolphins Game. Miami Gardens, Florida singer Gloria Estefan made a daring climb out a window after getting locked into a stadium suite during a Miami Dolphins game. The musician was watching the game against the New York Jets on Sunday from her suite at Sun Life Stadium and was set to introduce Latin singer Enrique Iglesias during the halftime show, but Estefan was locked inside. A locksmith, security officers, and firefighters tried unsuccessfully to unlock her door, so Estefan took matters into her own hands. WPLG-TV reports that Estefan kicked off her Dolphins green Yves Saint Laurent pumps and climbed out on the windowsill into the suite next door. She ran out the door and across the field and made it on stage just in time. The transition section of our program today is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com from their series, Today in Rock History. And today is the weekend of October 23 and October 24. Well, we jumped ahead a week on that one. Actually, today is the weekend of October 16 and 17. Sorry about that. Number one hits this weekend, October 16 and 17. Back in 1959, it was Bobby Darin with Mack the Knife. And a half a century ago this weekend, it was the Drifters with Save the Last Dance for Me. Back in 1964, it was Manfred Mann with Doo Wah Diddy Diddy. And in 1970, it was the Jackson 5 with I'll Be There. Back in 1976, you may remember that great hit by Rick Dees, Disco Duck. And back in 1993, it was Garth Brooks in Pieces. And in 1998, finally, it was Bare Naked Ladies with 1 Week. Now, if you're born on October 16th, you share a B-Day with C.F. Turner from Bachman Turner Overdrive. He was born on that day back in 1943. And Bob Ace Weir of the Grateful Dead was born on that day, October 16th, 1947. And, of course, Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers, born on that day, October 16, 1962. And if you were born on October 17, you share a birthday with James Seals of Seals and Croft. He was born on October 17, 1941. James Tucker of the Turtles, also born on that day, 1946. Ziggy Marley, 1968 on October 17th, and finally, Wyclef Jean, the Fugees, 1972 on October 17th. Deaths this weekend include Leonard Chess, he's the founder of Chess Records, from back in 1969, he died on that day. And also Billy Williams, I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter, died in 1972 this weekend, and Tennessee Ernie Ford died this weekend back in 1991. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1963, it was the Ronettes debuting on the charts with Be My Baby. A year later, 1964, the Kinks release All Day and All of the Night. Back 5 years after that, 1969, Led Zeppelin released Led Zeppelin II. And back in 1972, it was Creedence Clearwater Revival splitting up this weekend. And back in 1976, this weekend, it was Joan Armatrading debuting on the charts with Love and Affection. Back in 1986, this weekend, it was Chuck Berry's 60th birthday party, organized by Keith Richards and held in St. Louis. Back in 1992, this weekend, as a reaction to her ripping up a picture of the Pope, Sinead O'Connor is booed off the stage at a show honoring Bob Dylan at Madison Square Garden. In local rock news, we see this article by David Menconi, published in the News and Observer on September 5, 2010. It'll be hard to unseat Austin. Some years ago at South by Southwest, I was pulled over for going the wrong way down a one-way street in Austin, Texas. The police officer came to my window and I began trying to explain myself. I'd just arrived, got confused, and so on. I stopped talking when I noticed that he wasn't listening to me, but to the music coming out of my rental car's tape deck. "That's nice," he said with a nod toward the deck, and we briefly discussed the virtues of the group playing the Minus Five, featuring R.E.M.'s guitarist Peter Buck. After ascertaining that I had not been drinking, he let me go with a stern warning. Whenever I get asked whether or not a South by Southwest type event like the Hopscotch Music Festival could take off in Raleigh, I think back to that night. It says a lot about why Austin is different from most places and why South by Southwest works so well there. Raleigh and Austin do share many similarities. Both cities are state capital college towns that experience growth booms over the past 30 years. Both have well-educated populations and cultural amenities, and both have local music scenes that have earned national acclaim. But there are differences, too. It's not just that Austin has more of a live music infrastructure than most cities, inspiring the Chamber of Commerce slogan, "Live Music Capital of the World." It's that there's a larger critical mass of live music culture in Austin than in any other city I've ever seen. I went to graduate school at the University of Texas, and I've attended 23 out of the 24 South by Southwest. I can tell you that going to shows is just what people in Austin do, and it's been that way going back to the cosmic cowboy era of the 1970s, when Austin had the lowest cost of living of any American city, a fond and long-ago memory. The result is a musically literate, club-going population bigger than similar populations in much larger cities. South by Southwest started small with a handful of bands playing for a few hundred attendees in 1987, but it took off like a rocket, helped by a confluence of events to grow into the monolith it is now. Austin in March is one of the most appealing places on earth, with the bluebonnets just beginning to bloom and summertime heat still several months off. It's the perfect time and place for people from cold weather places to gather at spring break for the music industry. In recent years, South by Southwest has also expanded with an accompanying film festival and interactive media conference, both of them quite successful. But the music festival remains the main event. So much of it happens off the grid with unregistered attendees and bands who come for the party that it's difficult to say just how big South by Southwest is. But it's well over 1,000 bands with tens of thousands of people coming to listen. And the city's cab drivers, restaurant workers, and yes, cops are savvy enough about music to get it. Whichever niche Hopscotch finds, South by Southwest place at the top seems secure. This next article is downloaded from the website www.healingmusic.org. Medicine with a Melody by Kalanza L. Griffin, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, published on the 27th of July, 2001. With the strum of a guitar, the melodious whisper of a flute, or the mere power of her voice, Miriam Larson can use the soothing sounds of music to enlighten her clients about ways to handle stressful situations. And though she doesn't teach them how to sing or play instruments, she does help them use music to experience the unique psychological and neurological benefits it offers to patients with cognitive limitations. With music, they can deal with what they've been going through, says Larson, who works with clients at the Milwaukee Center for Independence. They're able to interact more verbally and to think more critically about life and what they feel good or bad about. Larson is one of more than 3,200 certified music therapists in the United States who now draw upon their love and understanding of music to help patients cope with health or educational problems. According to a recent membership survey by the American Music Therapy Association, music therapists work in 35 countries and are employed either full-time or by independent contractual positions in several settings, including hospitals, nursing homes, schools, and psychiatric facilities. Enrollment in music therapy programs at colleges and universities also has been on the rise, increasing 11% during the 1999-2000 academic year compared with the previous year's enrollment figures. The number of students who entered graduate programs for music therapy increased as well during this time. New research. Although the idea of using music to ease feelings of pain or discomfort is not new, its effectiveness compared to traditional medical care has not been readily known. However, more and more studies published in medical and musical journals, including the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, Lancet, and the Journal of Music Therapy, are finding that music can reduce blood pressure, improve immune function, and decrease the length of hospital stays for both children and adults. So the medical community is becoming increasingly aware of not only the popularity of music therapy, but the many ways that it can complement traditional medical treatment. As a discipline, we are doing a better job communicating to the medical community what we're doing, says John Hartman, music therapy director for the Milwaukee Center for Independence. Before, we were just saying, it's music, it's good, it works, but didn't have the research to back it up. But now there are results that show it's not just a fluke, but it's real, and it's helping, he said. Here are some of the ways. Music therapy has been shown to be an effective treatment for people with psychosocial, cognitive, and communicative disorders. Studies have found that music helps patients improve personal expression, self-esteem, and social interaction by providing a creative way for them to transform feelings of frustration, anger, or aggression into something that is fun and purposeful. Article skips down. Music provides a way of getting people in touch with things within themselves that they can't express otherwise, says Anthony Meyer, medical director of a Milwaukee hospital. It's something that we hear every day and take for granted, but it can be an avenue for self-expression added to our other methods of patient understanding and care. Mayer said that he has patients that use music therapy and that the changes he's seen in their behavior, mood, and mentality show that it really, really worked. The article skips down. A spokeswoman for the American Cancer Society says that music, both instrumental and vocal, helps to decrease feelings of pain and anxiety for cancer patients, and that she sometimes will follow patients throughout the entire surgical procedure to help them relax. In addition to cancer, studies have found that music improves well-being and relaxation for stroke and cardiac patients and those with traumatic brain injury. It also works for people who are terminally ill or who have chronic pain. Children. Music is a part of our growth and development, Lane said. Before they are even born, babies are perceiving heartbeat, water and blood sounds, and hearing their mother's voice. So sound and vibrations are already a part of you. For this reason, music therapists can use verbal and instrumental music to encourage development of speech, sensory motor skills, socialization, in children of all ages, she said. In premature babies, music therapy was associated with faster weight gain, according to an article in JAMA. Nancy Dexter Shabo, a private practice therapist, said she uses the therapy for children with visual, learning, or language impairments, and that she has done so with children as young as 6 months. She said that a music therapist often works in collaboration with other healthcare professionals, such as physicians, speech, physical, and occupational therapists, to help get the best results from a child. At the Center for Blind and Visually Impaired Children, music therapy is a part of each child's daily schedule. Music gives us another opportunity to teach children skills, says Linda Bell, executive director of the center. And since we're talking about children without vision, it helps to stimulate them to use other senses. Bell said that with music, she's seen children become motivated to crawl, sit for longer periods, and use parts of their body that were usually too stiff for motion. The overall goal is to increase attention to what we're doing, increase interaction with their instructor, therapist, and peers, and increase their expressive communication. The article skips down. Listening to music helps clients reduce stress, resolve conflict, and take control of their lives. That's the beauty of music therapy and also one of its difficulties, Hartman said. If they like jazz, we use jazz. If they like pop rock, we use pop rock. Because if people hear music and they don't like it, they won't respond and the therapy will not be successful. Article skips down and ends with this. The big common denominator for music therapy is the brain and how it processes music. She said music stimulates the entire brain and often can be used to retrain parts of the brain to do new functions. Medicine is bringing us so far, but it doesn't provide all the ways for treatment, she said. And as we learn more about the human organism and people learn about treatment with music, more people will be seeking it out. So what do you know about our featured artist, Beach House? Well, according to Anthony Carew from About.com Guide, this bio. They were formed in 2004 in Baltimore, Maryland, and their key albums are Beach House from 2006, Devotion from 2008, and Teen Dream that just came out this year, 2010. Beach House are a duo, not a couple, as they often point out, from Baltimore. Built on the vocals and organ of Victoria Legrand and the atmospheric slide guitar of Alex Galley, they wear frequent comparisons to Nico and Mazzy Star and are heavily influenced by Neil Young and the films of David Lynch. Their music is slow, drony, dreamlike, and narcotic. That's very much what the Beach House feel is, going off to a different world, Scaly explained in 2008. It's not really a vacation. A vacation for me is when you go away, but you're still thinking about all the things you've left behind. Much of the response to their music, Legrand believes, comes from the name. People immediately think living in the cabana, she told the Village Voice, smoking opium, listening to Galaxy 500, spiritualized. I know that there's drug references and things like that, but when we write, we're definitely not succumbing to the influence of drugs or imagining that at all. Background. Legrand was born into an artistic family as the daughter of a painter and the niece of a French composer, Michel Legrand, and singer Christine Legrand. The Beach House vocalist was born in Paris, raised in Philadelphia, and returned to the city of her birth to study acting at the International Théâtre, School of Jacques Lecoq in Paris. I've been performing all of my life in theaters, so it's very natural for me to be in front of people on stage, Legrand recalled. Every time we play, I try and use all those performative things that are ingrained in me. I think the minute you're on stage, you're performing. On graduation, Legrand moved to Baltimore, in part because of cheap rent, but also impelled by a weird gut feeling. 6 months after moving there in 2004, she met Scaly, and the two quickly started hanging out all the time, eventually leading to a musical collaboration. Everything about it was easy and was very natural, Legrand recounted in 2008. It was just like two friends being around one another and talking about music and loving organs and loving pianos and loving four tracks. And this kind of intense baby was born. We were two people who had very similar colors in their minds. Scaly was a Baltimore native who had grown up playing bass guitar, studied geology at university, and eventually found employment as a carpenter. Before Beach House, Scaly was never a guitarist. It's been great because I was never taught on that instrument, so I've been able to play exactly how I want and not have preconceived notions about what the guitar role is. Beginnings. Beach House started out life as a recording project, yet rather than using multi-tracking to build grand songs, they stuck to the simplicity of their setup: organ, programmed drum, slide guitar. It's a way to challenge ourselves. What do you do when it's just the two of you, Legrand said to Pitchfork. Offered Scaly, one of the reasons this has been such a fulfilling experience for me is that with two people, it's so much easier to achieve things that feel exciting and new. After a year as a recording project, Beach House began playing around Baltimore and recorded their 2006 self-titled debut in the space of 2 days. Though made without a label, the band was soon signed by Car Park Records. Beach House soon became a blog band, the Internet's embrace symbolized by the ever-influential Pitchfork, who awarded the band their Best New Music tag. We know we're an Internet band, Scaly has offered. That's how we've always been, real small but with really devoted fans. In 2008, Beach House released their second album, Devotion, a more dynamic set whose songs were, Scaly claimed, incredibly high in intensity, born of bottled-up emotions from touring and increased creative tensions between the two. The album found more critical love, and the band's fan base continued to grow, aided by tours with Fleet Foxes and Grizzly Bear. Breakout. In 2009, Beach House signed to Sub Pop Records, and the first fruits of that union were 2010's impressive Teen Dream. The album's title, Legrand explained, described the feelings that they had making it, youthful and obsessed, completely inspired by everything in this overwhelming, irrational, passionate way. Recorded in a converted church in upstate New York, the album summoned a sense of grandeur beyond the hazy mood music of the band's first two records and was summarily received with critical rapture. Beach House will close out today's program as well with Used to Be. But first, these articles. Time Magazine from the 4th of October 2010. Question and Answer. Ben Folds and Nick Hornby. The former frontman of Ben Folds 5 has teamed up with the author of High Fidelity to create Lonely Avenue, an album of touching piano-driven pop that sounds almost like a collection of short stories. How does the songwriting process work when one of you, Hornby, can't play music? Folds. Nick just wrote that what was in his head. He turned his thoughts into lyrics and emailed them to me. Hornby. We tried it once with Ben sending me an existing melody and me writing words to fit, but the other way was much better. Belinda is about a musician forced to sing an old love song written for someone he no longer loves. Has that happened to you? Folds. No, I don't feel that way about the songs I'm singing. Once I write a song, it becomes like a cover. I don't relate to it anymore. I feel like I'm singing Woolly Bully or something. Why did you write a song about Bristol Palin's ex Levy Johnson? Hornby says, Levy seemed like a good metaphor for all the mistakes that we make when we're kids and the price that we pay for them. Folds adds, it's like the expiration date on milk. You vaguely know when it will go bad, but for him it was like, uh-oh, time's up. What's it like to compose a love song for your wife when you can't play music? Hornby answers, I hope Ben might provide a kind of insouciant, upbeat melody, but he went for the big ballad because he knew it was a love song. So then I got found out. This article is written by Claire Suddoth for Time Magazine on the 4th of October, 2010. This final article is by Simon Vozik Levinson, published in Entertainment Weekly on the 8th of October, 2010, entitled John Lennon's Solo Years, a Major Reissue Campaign Marks What Would Have Been the Beatles' 70th Birthday. John Lennon's 70th birthday this October 9th ought to have been a chance to absorb whatever new sounds he was making as he entered old age. Since that is sadly impossible, why not honor his memory by listening again to the 8 albums he recorded under his own name? A handsome, if pricey, new 11-CD box set presents all 8 in freshly remastered form, plus another disc of Slipshod demos and one more of non-album singles. Also available is a separate, new 4-disc set that groups 72 songs thematically, as well as yet another 1-disc hits, 1-hits compilation. The reissues are also sold individually, or maybe you'd prefer to dig out the perfectly serviceable remasters that each album already received over the past 10 years. But however you choose to consume it, the time has never been better to rediscover the unpredictable, challenging music Lennon recorded in his 30s. The article skips down and ends with this. For the millions of fans still grieving, the best and only consolation is to keep immersing themselves in the complicated catalog he left behind. Year after year, decade after decade, listen enough times and you might be able to imagine another, fairer world where his musical journey didn't have to end so soon. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? What rock group's only beardless member is Frank Beard? And I gave you a big hint there about Rolling Papers' ZZ Top. Question number 2, what Beatles song advises One Thing I Can Tell You If You Gotta Be Free? That was the first song on their Abbey Road album, 1969, Come Together.
Now
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.